So I want to talk to you a little bit about one way of looking at kind of what I was thinking about for this retreat is in the morning, sort of talking about this arena of compassion and balance with discordant views on a conventional level, and in the afternoon, kind of getting more into a ultimate level, you might see, might say. So let's see how this goes. We're having, oh, the speaker. Yeah, there's something that hit there. We're having a problem with a phone here that'll stop the, you might just turn the volume down all the way too. That might do it. I think there's a volume tab on the side. Okay, well, they're figuring it out. So I'm recording. So, you know, here we are in 2025. And, you know, it sounds like this is a uniquely difficult time in many ways. Of course, you know, let's not forget about World War II or the Civil War or the Napoleonic Wars or the Inquisition, or we tend to do these things, we humans. We make things really difficult. We conflict with each other. And we may find ourselves here with others whose actions we dislike. We dislike their actions, and then we slip into disliking those people or detesting them. And then there's this big barrier, and then there's fear and separation, and then we hurt, and we're out of harmony with our sisters and brothers. And on the path, even a shade of detesting someone or condemning someone as intrinsically evil or wrong or flawed is a downfall, you might say, on the path. Because the Buddha constantly focused on everyone's potential to awaken. That's how he lived for 40 years. That's what he did. Never wavered from that. So to bring it to our hearts, anyone who we think is horrendously wrong is just like us in their capacity to awaken. Sorry, the mic was off. So let's go deeper into that, into deep compassion and even loving kindness toward all beings, no matter what we may think about their actions and attitudes. And when we learn that there are no enemies, then we can find equanimity in the midst of tumult and disagreement. So we're not going to talk about political parties or anything like that during this. And we already talked about that. But there's a way in which these difficult times are a gift, because it makes us go deeper. It makes us look into how the potential of others and our potential are the same. And someone with whom we disagree is exactly the same as us. And the more we can open that up, the more we can actually see our own potential. So right in the midst of the difficulty is a possibility. And, you know, there's definitely global challenges. I get that. Climate change, nuclear weapons, the whole deal. There's significant peril. And we may feel powerless. So how do we navigate that as Dharma practitioners while still doing our practice and deepening our practice in the middle of whatever we choose to do or not do? And it's a real place to be very mindful about the choices we're making and to see why and navigate through it all consciously. And so a key question is, can we find or cultivate loving kindness and compassion even towards those who are perpetrating the worst things? Can we do that? Can we cultivate that? Maybe we won't feel it, but can we cultivate that as an intention, at least? It's a huge thing. It's a huge thing. And it may seem like, really? That's ridiculous. Or that's just too much. But maybe not. So it's interesting to look at beings who stand out in the late 20th century and early 21st who manifested kindness even when they were confronted personally with hatred. And this shows us a lot. So I'm going to give you the list, short list of beings. The Buddha, well, that's not 20th century, but anyway, forget what I said. But the Buddha, Jesus, Mahatma Gandhi, Nelson Mandela, Martin Luther King, Thich Nhat Hanh, the Dalai Lama. In all those cases, those beings were, and in the case of the Dalai Lama, still are, up against organizations, Chinese government in his case, who demonize, try to thwart, kill colleagues, all of that. And of these people I mentioned, many of them were thrown in jail repeatedly. Many of them were beaten. Several of them were assassinated. It's pretty amazing that in the middle of all that, part of what they did was they didn't demonize the other. It's extraordinary. And that was part of how they were successful. Nelson Mandela didn't. Martin Luther King didn't. It's amazing. And it shows us how we can do that too. So this is not just a bunch of, you know, Tibetan masters living in caves. These are like people right in the middle of the mayhem. And they also were active. They also got stuff done. So it's not just, you know, kind of an ephemeral separation. They were engaged and they didn't demonize others. Now, in 1952, Dr. King said about Jesus' commitment to love thy enemy in the Sermon on the Mount. He said, let me, this is Martin Luther King speaking. I tend to quote things, by the way, when I'm teaching. So, let me hasten to add that Jesus was very serious when he gave this command. He wasn't playing. He realized that it's hard to love your enemies. He realized that it's difficult to love those persons who seek to defeat you, those persons who say evil things about you. He realized that it was painfully hard, pressingly hard, but he wasn't playing. And we cannot dismiss this passage as just another example of Oriental hyperbole, just a sort of exaggeration to get over the point. This is a basic philosophy of all that we hear coming from the lips of our master. So that is a beautiful statement of how Dr. King lived and what he saw in his teacher, the Buddha. Now, the Buddha's life, as some of you know, how many people know much about the Buddha's life? Quite a bit. Yeah, okay. So he was a privileged son of a Sakya king, or at least local royalty in some form, left the palace at 29, achieved enlightenment 6 years later, and then for 40 years wandered northern India teaching until he died at about 80. But he faced challenges in his life, in those 40 years, right in the middle of it. He faced challenges that were pretty extreme. His very own cousin, Devadatta, tried multiple times to kill the Buddha. He hired assassins. He rolled a boulder trying to crush the Buddha. He had a maddened elephant charge after him. This is his cousin, by the way. In case you got family problems, you know. And then in his life, India didn't exist at that time. There were these kingdoms. So it was Kosala and Magadha. And he traveled he went about 300 miles up and down the Ganges Valley and traveled between those kingdoms. And at times they were warring or warring against other ones with all this. It was a very fluid, very conflicting kind of environment he was in. And then during his years, King Bimbisara, which is one of his first supporters in the Magadha kingdom, was imprisoned by his own son. It was a coup d'etat. Coup d'etat, his own son overturned him. King Bimbisara starved to death and right near the bamboo grove in Vulture's Peak, where the Buddha spent a lot of time. He just starved to death, his supporter. And the other royal family, King Pasenadi, he also was deposed by his own son and also died because of that, all within the Buddha's lifetime. So whatever we think of what the political situation is, that was even crazier. It was complete chaos going on. And this is when all of the great suttas that you read, all the great teachings that he gave, were right in the middle of all this stuff happening. So he was working with that, you know. He was experiencing pain. You could get into the whole question of pain and suffering, but he was experiencing pain during that. He wasn't suffering because he was awakened, but he's experiencing pain. And he kept relating with compassion. It's pretty amazing. So that's a context for his own uncompromising position about only returning love and not hatred toward all beings, even when their actions are despicable. And it was fully tested. This wasn't just theoretical. He was like right in the middle of the mess that he said this. There's a sutta, famous sutta, called the Simile of the Saw. I'm going to read a chunk of it. He said, when others address you, their speech may be timely or untimely. When others address you, their speech may be true or untrue. When others address you, their speech may be gentle or harsh. When others address you, their speech may be connected with good or with harm. When others address you, their speech may be spoken with a mind of loving kindness or with inner hate. Here in bhikkhus, you should train thus. Our minds will remain unaffected, and we shall utter no evil words. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare with a mind of loving kindness without inner hate. We shall abide pervading that person with a mind imbued with loving kindness. And now he ups the ante. He says, bhikkhus, even if bandits were to sever you savagely limb by limb with a two-handled saw, he who... there you go. He who gave rise to a mind of hate toward them would not be carrying out my teaching. Herein, bhikkhus, you should train thus. Our minds will remain unaffected, and we shall utter no evil words. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare with a mind of loving kindness without inner hate. We shall abide pervading them with a mind imbued with loving kindness, and starting with them, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, and without ill will. That is how you should train bhikkhus. So as you can see, it's a high bar. But he really did it. He really did it. And we can too. But it's a practice. It takes depth. It takes going within to return difficulty with loving kindness. But it may be. That's what the world needs more than anything. So as you know, loving kindness, metta in Pali, it's a key value that he taught. It means cultivating goodwill toward all beings, not because we like them or they're, you know, fun or cute, but just because they're sentient beings. And the Metta Sutta, the beautiful little chunk of it, he said, let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her child, with her life, her child, her only child, with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Now, this seems kind of idealistic, but if you kind of get down in there a little bit at what he's saying, because this is not a question of liking. This is a question of cultivating loving kindness for all beings because they're just like us, because they can awaken just like us. They are, have that same quality. And when he says, let none deceive another or despise any being in any state, that's where he starts. And he's looking exactly toward a difficult being, or else why would we be tempted to despise them? So he's saying, don't do that. Don't despise any being in state, no matter what they do. Steering us away from ill will toward anyone, even those who are causing the biggest problems. And the next four lines, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, with a boundless heart, should one cherish all living beings. So let me ask, how many parents here? Quite a few parents, yeah, okay. So I'm not a mother, obviously, but I'm a parent. And knowing many parents over many years, sometimes one's offsprings are the most difficult beings imaginable. Sometimes, right? They tell us we're stupid, they crash our cars, they get addicted on drugs, they piddle away their educational opportunities, and we cultivate love toward them. Because that's what we got to do. You know, that's what we got to do. It's what they need to get through it all. No one else is much different. So he's reminding us, just like a mother, that's how we should relate to all sentient beings, even those We may disagree with politically, just like there are children. With a boundless heart, cherishing all living beings. So this isn't, a language of familial bonds, all those kinds of like spheres of bonding, which are great, but they're often connected with, they're like me, so I'm connected with them, or they're separate from the others, so we are the family and they're out there. This is bigger than that. It's all beings. And it's not romantic love either. And romantic love, as we all know, is a little tricky because, you fall in love with someone, but how much of the deal is there's something that you want out of the experience? It's complicated. How much of it is really caring about the person? How much of it is I'm in love with them and I want an experience because they're so cool or something. So this is bigger than that. Bigger than that. Boundless love. Boundless love. So one way to look at this is to keep recognizing the potential for Buddhahood in every being. And when you read the suttas, it starts to become clear that the Buddha, that's what he's doing. The suttas are, how many people read the suttas much? Anybody? Some? Yeah, okay, good, good. The suttas are a whole huge collection of stories of encounters, to a large degree. Stories of encounters with people, some of whom want to learn different aspects of what the Buddha is teaching, some of whom are trying to undercut them, trick them, fool them, divert them, all kinds of stuff. And in every case, he's constantly just relating to their potential for awakening. He doesn't get stuck. It's always this sense of, oh, you can feel it. When you start to sort of, you start to, over time, start to realize he's just teasing forward what's possible in every being, no one excluded. It's pretty amazing. But it's a model for how we can look at it. And I think this becomes clearer in practice. It becomes clearer that that's, oh yeah, what else could we do? Angulimala. Who knows who Angulimala was? Yeah, a couple of hands. Angulimala. So he's often considered, a little story here, the world's first serial killer. He had killed 999 people. And the name Angulimala, Anguli is finger, and mala is a necklace, so he had a necklace of 99 fingers from all of the people he'd killed. And he was a contemporary of the Buddha, kind of a forest-dwelling brigand, a murderer of awesome power. He terrorized the region around Jetavana Monastery in Srivasti, up in what is now Uttar Pradesh, where the Buddha grew up. And this is just a metaphor, because to this day, there's brigands and stuff in the forests, like in Bihar. I mean, it's tricky. If you ever go to Bodh Gaya and you arrive in Gaya on a train and it's 12 kilometers to Bodh Gaya, they say, well, don't go at night. People say, don't do a motor rickshaw at night. You may, whole buses get hijacked during that 12 miles with all these Taiwanese and their passports get taken, so it can be a little hairy. So point being, this isn't just metaphor. So according to the Sutta, MN 86, he was so bloodthirsty that he just transformed the region. Brutal, bloody-handed, devoted to killing and slaying, showing no mercy for living beings. He turned villages into non-villages, towns into non-towns, settled countryside into unsettled countryside. Maybe worse than any contemporary persons that we have problems with, perhaps. Huh?
My life.
Yeah. So the Buddha, but he intuited some potential in Angulimala that was lost on everyone else. Because this one day, after alms round, he set his lodging in order, got his bowl, and went off into the forest to meet Angulimala, just a monk in a bowl. We can't maybe meet our most dreaded despot, whoever that is, but there's an attitude there of going in our heart to meet them where they are. That's what the Buddha did. He went to meet Angulimala where he was. And it's interesting that I don't quite know the significance, but he brought his bowl, which is very interesting because he'd already done the alms round. So why did he bring his bowl? I think it was almost like a symbol of this interdependence. It's very interesting that he did that. I've never asked about that. But this was a big deal, and people were freaking out that the Buddha was doing this. They begged him not to do this, and he remained silent, which is so interesting. It often happens in the suttas that the Buddha will bring up a subject, like people ask what, you know, questions about whether the Buddha is here or not here after the next lifetime, and he remains silent, or about karma questions, the things he remains, because it's so deep, there's no way to articulate it. So here, he just remains silent about why he's going. But the villagers knew that this was a bad plan, and that he was heading for certain death. And it says the cowherds, shepherds, and farmers saw him going along the road to where Angulimala was staying, and on seeing him, said to him, "Don't go along that road, contemplative, for on that road is Angulimala, brutal, bloody-handed, devoted to killing and slaying. Groups of 10, 20, 30, or 40 men have gone along that road, and they have fallen into Angulimala's hands." So Angulimala saw the Buddha coming. He said, "Oh, this will be easy, low-hanging fruit, this simple monk. There's my 1,000th finger. I'll have done my mala." So he got his sword and shield and buckled on his gear and started off after the Buddha. And the Buddha didn't usually exercise his psychic powers, but this was an exception. And try as he might, Angulimala could not catch up. And if you kind of picture this, he's this incredibly powerful warrior thundering along, and the Buddha is serenely walking along, and Angulimala can't catch up. And he says, Angulimala says, "Isn't it amazing? Isn't it astounding? In the past, I've chased and seized even a swift-running elephant, and now, running with all my might, I can't catch up." So he calls out to the Buddha, "Stop, contemplative, stop." And the Buddha turns around and says, "I have stopped, Angulimala, you stop." And the deal was, the Buddha knew that there was something in him would hear, and Angulimala got it, and he heard it. And we wonder, we think that those whom we hate, they're too far gone. There's something just wrong with them. They're evil. The Buddha knew this guy. I mean, nobody's evil, but the Buddha knew there was a moment of possibility. And he says, "At long last, a deeply revered great seer, for my sake, caring for me, has come to the great forest. Having heard your verse in line with the Dhamma, I will go about having abandoned evil." And he bows to the Buddha, requests to go forth. The Buddha makes him a monk, and Angulimala is awakened. In that lifetime, he awakened. There's still a stupa in northern India dedicated to him. So that's crazy. Kills 999 people, and he awakens in the same lifetime. I mean, we're still trying to awaken here, and he did it. But there was some potential, and that sort of shows, I say all this because it points to, we don't know, this infinite potential in all beings that the Buddha saw, that we can take into our hearts as we navigate the complexities of it all. I'm going to run a tiny bit, but that's okay. So in the sutta, it says, Metta-sutta, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbound, freed from hatred and ill will. So we're called to radiate kindness, to really bring that into our hearts, to radiate kindness no matter what, exactly to the people with whom we most disagree, which can be political figures, international despots, our own loving partners when they're being very difficult. All of those things. And Jesus also focused on this in the Sermon on the Mount. He says, "You have heard that it is," this is a Sermon on the Mount now, "you have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? And if you greet only your own people, what are you doing more than others? Do not even pagans do that? Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect." So isn't that interesting? He's doing exactly the same, directing us not just to be kind to those it's easy to be kind to, but also to those it's most difficult to be kind to. So So how do we develop compassion for difficult persons? There's a great Dharma book, which I highly recommend, The Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. It's got different titles. You can find it on the internet. There's about five different translations written by Shantideva in the 8th century. He was an Indian pundit. He was at Nalanda University, which was for 700 years the center of Buddhist scholarly studies in what is now Bihar. But within this book, a most precious chapter is the one on patience. The Dalai Lama has given entire week-long teachings on that chapter. And it's basically about how our greatest teacher of patience is just the person who's most difficult for us. That's our greatest teacher. The chapter in one place reads, "Thus, since patient acceptance is produced in dependence upon one with a very hateful mind, that person should be worthy of veneration, just like the sacred Dharma, because he is a cause of patience." So that person with a hateful mind is our teacher, because they are a cause, an opportunity to cultivate patience. Dalai Lama says it slightly differently. He says, "Our enemies provide us with a precious opportunity to practice patience and love. We should have gratitude toward them." And again, this isn't just like ivory tower stuff, right? I mean, the Dalai Lama pushed out of his country, 1 million Tibetans killed, most of the monasteries destroyed by the Chinese, and he can say that. How amazing is that?